I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Our country has long maintained the importance of an educated citizenry, but how do we ensure children are getting the most of a public school education and given an opportunity to reach his or her full potential? Joining us in studio, Mary Gantz. She's the principal at Falmouth High School. Welcome
back,
Mary. And Carol Locke, president of the Massachusetts Association for Gifted Education. Good morning to you, Carol.
Good morning, everyone.
And on the phone, Rich Robison. He's the executive director of the Federation for Children with Special Needs. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning.
We also want to hear from parents and guardians of children in public schools. What are some of the ways you make sure your child is succeeding and enjoying school? 866-999-4626 is our number, or send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. The rationale behind a free public education is that an educated citizenry benefits all of society. Early in the history of public education in the United States, this entailed the basics, reading, writing, and arithmetic. But in the past few decades, we've seen the number of topics included in a public education curriculum expand. So, Mary, give us a sense of the different topics a public school curriculum is mandated to cover.
Well, we're certainly mandated to cover math and English, as those are our state standardized tests, but also science, social studies, and even under the math standards, art, fine art classes, art, music are considered core courses that are required. So in order to graduate from Falmouth High School, we do have credit requirements that cover a wide variety of subject areas.
Do you know, is that true pretty much across the Cape? Yeah.
Yes.
In the islands? Sorry. So there's a spectrum of learning styles and cognitive abilities in students. How has the public education system changed over the past few decades to address those different abilities? And Rich, let's start with you on this one.
Well, the requirements that all students participate really started in the 70s with the passage of Chapter 766, the Massachusetts Special Education Law. That particular law predated the federal IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and both of those required that all students fully participate in a public education and receive the same education as any other student.
Anybody else want to chime in?
That's really good. I think things changed a bit when No Child Left Behind came along and we had the standardized testing. There were kids on both ends of the spectrum that aren't totally involved in this because we have this proficiency level that really has become the focal point rather than the individual students.
Mm-hmm. Mary, let me ask, I know a little bit more about the special education aspect of it, as I had a daughter who went through that. With the testing, a lot of the special education students aren't able to take the MCAS test, and they have these portfolios. Has that changed? Are they still doing that portfolio? Because as I recall, there was maybe one student who actually passed with that portfolio.
They do still do the portfolios, but we have most of our students do. And generally, in order to qualify to do, they call it the MCAS alternative portfolio instead of the MCAS test, you have to basically be a high school student who's at a third grade level or below. Mm-hmm. But at Falmouth High School, we actually, special ed students who are above that level take the regular MCAS, and we have an incredible passing rate.
Oh,
We do a lot of, I think the way what you asked about things changing is we've looked at how do we address every student's individual needs mm-hmm. in the classroom. We just have some incredible teachers at Falmouth High School who are able to do that on a daily basis.
I can attest to that because I remember with the reading, it's like, okay, Wilson method, this method, doesn't work. Let's create our own, which they actually did. And Rich, I'm wondering if you find that in a lot of the other schools. Do you find that the schools are, I guess it depends on the district, right? Who's more flexible about, you know, kids' learning styles?
Well, the use of the MCAS ALT is required under federal and state law. And it's reserved for students with significant intellectual disability primarily. And so it's really a small number of students overall in the statewide population that participate in that. All the other students are expected to participate in the general system, and the school districts are required to do what they can to help that student make the best possible progress. It's not really a new mandate, and I would suggest that it was even before No Child Left Behind. Access to the general curriculum was instituted in the federal law in 97 when there was a reauthorization of the Individuals mm-hmm. with Disabilities mm-hmm. Education Act and was part of the Goals 2000. So it's been around for a while. It certainly has morphed and changed as time has gone on in terms of people's expectations. But the notion is that every child needs the opportunity to fully engage in their education.
Yeah. Rich, how are children identified as special needs? There's a particular criteria they must meet, right?
There are 13 federal categories of disability that the schools are mandated to look for under something called Child Find, which is a provision of the law that says that you have to ensure that if you suspect a child has a disability, that they are evaluated and determined whether they're eligible. Mm-hmm. And so it's really across the board. It's social-emotional, it's intellectual, it's learning disabilities, it's autism, it's really the whole gamut of possible conditions.
Yeah. And Mary, by the time they get to high school, they're usually, this usually happens in the younger grades, right?
Not necessarily. No? I think because different disabilities can, you know, come about at different levels and grade levels. And what he was saying about Child Find, it's even expanding for social emotional reasons. Now there's a question whether districts, you know, if you have a student who may have exhibited suicidal ideation, is that a Child Find obligation on part of the district to test that student? So I think it's ever, mm-hmm. I think we have many students, even in high school, where parents may say, or guardians, my child has struggled all along. I really think he or she may have a learning disability, and I would like him tested. And once the parent requests, we are mandated to test.
All right. So mm-hmm. Carol, historically, how did public schools meet the needs of students considered gifted?
There was a huge push, and I think this came with the space race era, and a lot of people felt like the best way to get people into STEM was to encourage the really bright students. And I grew up in Virginia, Northern Virginia, and had gazillion resources. And I can remember when I was taking AP Calculus in high school, we had an eighth grader in that class, and he'd go back to the middle school for his other subjects, but he was in our calculus class. And teachers just were so able to identify and see these kids and find niches for them. We had one guidance counselor for like every 50 students, and the kids were allowed to, you know, move forward. And people really encouraged this. I can remember, you know, hearing bright kids getting awards being announced over the PA system, just like the football team won a game. And it was pretty exciting being in that place in that time. In the town of Framingham, which is where I'm from, we had kids that one parent and a couple teachers got together and wrote this grant 40 years ago and studied the best way to deal with these gifted kids. This Framingham study ended up being used nationwide, replicated all over the place. And in fact, my sister in Texas said to me, "I can't believe this study. How come your whole state doesn't do this?" Mm-hmm. And the SAGE program has been limping along, but is still alive in Framingham, very fortunately, because my daughter had phenomenal benefits from that. But I think it has waxed and waned. Even the federal Javits grant money has just gone down, down, down. When that program was still alive, we had someone at the Department of Education here in Massachusetts responsible for doing that. But since about 2002, there really has been very little attention paid to the kids on that end of the bell curve. Mm-hmm. And there's about, I would say, 3-5% that are profoundly gifted. The fourth grader doing 11th grade mm-hmm. math and things like this. But we also have a huge number of students that are very bored. A Johns Hopkins study recently came out and said that where they do measure students above grade level, 10-30% of students are one or more grade levels above where they're put according to the standards. And so Massachusetts has just said they do fine, they're proficient, they don't need any services, and there are absolutely no laws for these students at all.
Mary, what do you do with gifted students in the Falmouth school system?
I think, and to respond to what Carol said, even if a child may be a grade level ahead in one area, I don't think that having that child in the grade level, if the chronological grade level, depending on the teacher, and in Falmouth, I know we have just phenomenal teachers, the child's not being hurt in that grade level. And teachers are always doing enhancement activities to, you know, further that child's education. I see at Falmouth High School and through grants from the Falmouth Education Foundation, which is incredible, teachers mm-hmm. are able to get grants to do so many different things to reach every single student. I think the thing about public education is we take what's out there, you
right,
know, we
right.
and we have to. And I know as a public high school principal, I don't want to work in a school where we can pick and choose who comes through our doors. And so I think that when a student or a teacher sees a student who this student's really excelling in AP chemistry, I know our AP chemistry teacher would give that student additional higher level work to do. So I mm-hmm. think it really is an individual relationship situation.
Yeah, depends on the school. It really is as to what's happening. Rich, maybe you can explain what an IEP is and how those are created. That's an individual education plan.
Surely. The IEP is a document that is a planning document that's required under state and federal law where the concerns that the school has about the student or what the parent concerns might be are brought together through the process of an evaluation or several evaluations to look at what the student will benefit from in school so that they can fully participate in the life of the school and the curriculum that's being presented to them. Mm. I like to view it as somebody who needs eyeglasses. I didn't need those in my earlier years, but in the last few years I did. With them, I can see quite readily and access everything that I need to access. But if I don't have those with me, obviously I can't make progress. And special ed services, the IEP, I view as kind of the services that help level that playing field for a student so that they can really participate effectively and not fall behind.
Mm. And some of those IEP meetings, I think once they get to high school, they don't seem as tough. But in the early years, they can be, you know, quite, it might be a disagreement, let's say, on what the parents think a kid needs and the, you know, school administrators. And it's a team, basically, right, Mary? That's,
yes.
that's sitting down with the family and you evaluate these on an annual basis.
Yes. And they can be contentious at the high school, too, because I think, you know, the high school is the end road.
Mm-hmm.
And you really, as a parent or a guardian, want to make sure that the IEP is fully servicing your child and that the school is complying with it. I mean, mm-hmm. as Rich said, you know, it's basically a prescription that we're legally obligated to comply with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when a student is identified as special needs, what are the responsibilities of the school system then to meet those needs? I mean, this can be quite expensive for a school system. You don't know from year to year how many special needs students you're going to have.
Exactly. And it can range from a student who simply needs notes provided to him or her to preferential seating. And that could even be in the back of the class or in the front of the class, wherever that student can focus best to services with a special ed teacher, you know, mm-hmm. being a co-teaching model. Even services with an adjustment counselor can be on an IEP. You know, if a student needs extra counseling or support through that, a student may have X number of minutes per week that he or she needs to access the adjustment counselor.
Now, I know you're not the superintendent, but this is a problem that the superintendents have from year to year is that sometimes you have out-of-district placements. So a child may need to go to a different school that's specific for whatever their disability is. And that transportation budget is huge.
Yes, transportation and the out-of-district placement costs, the tuition costs are significant as well. And like you said, a superintendent, it's so hard to, our superintendent does her best to anticipate those costs and look ahead. And she actually really looks at every individual child in the entire system. And I think that if you are able to predict a little bit where a student may end up down the road, if it's an out-of-district placement, you can budget accordingly. But it really is very difficult to do.
Yeah. Rich, do you want to chime in on that?
Well, the only thing that I would add is that the state has put together a program called the Circuit Breaker mm-hmm, for Special mm-hmm. Education, which is a funding mechanism that if a school district experiences an extraordinary placement unanticipated, that they can apply for money to reimburse that. And there also is a tuition reimbursement program as a part of that particular bill. It's funded at the level of almost $300 million
oh, wow.
statewide, mm-hmm. so it's fairly robust. And the legislature has been very supportive because they recognize that these kinds of unanticipated expenses could really, you know, impact the local budget. the key, I think, as Mary was saying, was, you know, that the school committee and the superintendent need to really be planful about what they anticipate the needs to be, mm-hmm. so that they can adapt to those particular needs. Yeah.
And are there still a lot of federal mandates that are unfunded?
Well, that's a complicated question. The short answer is sure. And in special education, when special education was initially passed back in 1975, the federal government promised to provide 40% of the extraordinary cost to local cities and towns. And in fact, that's never materialized in the federal budget. Mm. So I think it's probably much more modest in the 12-13% range. What that then becomes the discussion about what does full funding of IDEA really mean? And when they talk about that, they're talking about getting the federal reimbursement up to the 40% level. But nobody has been successful in 40-plus years in achieving that goal.
Rich, there was a recent Supreme Court decision about special education. Does that decision have any impact on how Massachusetts delivers services to special needs students?
Yeah, for those that don't know, the legal standard in the federal law is called free appropriate public education. The Supreme Court in the 80s had defined that as making just minimum progress. And recently, within the last month, the Supreme Court has revealed a new decision around free appropriate public education we call FAPE that says that more progress is needed so that the student can make effective progress in the current environment around curricula and high standards education. In Massachusetts, we've always had a higher standard. Even though we use the word FAPE, the way in which it has been interpreted in the state usually is a little bit more robust than what the previous decision would have called for.
We're talking about getting the most of a public school education. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about getting the most out of a public school education with Mary Gans, principal at Falmouth High School, Carol Locke, president of the Massachusetts Association for Gifted Education, and on the phone, Rich Robeson, executive director of the Federation for Children with Special Needs. We'd love to hear from you. What are some of the ways you make sure your child is succeeding and enjoying school? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Mary, we talked about IEPs for special needs students. We talked about the Circuit Breaker Fund. Anything like that for the gifted kids?
No, there are no regulations whatsoever, and particularly for the profoundly gifted kids who claim that they sit in the classroom and do nothing but wait and wait and wait and wait for years and repeat things they knew 5 years ago. These kids have no place to turn in Massachusetts, and it's pretty tough on the parents. It's probably 3-5% of the population. And the parents, if they try to homeschool their kids, are caught in the dilemma of where do they get the money and try to live on one salary. And particularly, we've tried to work with a couple of parents in New Bedford and in Holyoke just to get a kid advanced in one subject area. And it's a huge amount of work mm-hmm. trying to get a school district to stop and pay attention to this, because it means nothing to the district. It's, you know, they don't get points for it, but boy, do they get dinged and scooted down the in the rabbit hole, so to speak, if they don't make their annual progress and things like that. So it's pretty tough. Yeah.
And Mary, you mentioned that in Falmouth, anyway, that the teachers have the flexibility. And I'm thinking about, and so I imagine this depends on the school district again. But talking about teacher flexibility, when you have a classroom and maybe you have a group of students who have an interest somewhere over here, but you have to teach what's on that MCAS test, is there really enough room to be that flexible when they have to get that, you know, curriculum that's on the test to these students?
I think yes and no. At Falmouth High School, we actually just implemented a flex time period during our day that every student and every staff member is on during this. We call it Clipper time because the Clipper Ship is our mascot. And it truly actually came out of an EASC requirement, but it is a 33-minute period for every single student who, any student struggling, middle of the road, you know, extremely bright, can go see his or her teacher, any teacher, during that period to get extra support. And I can give an example of what a teacher did. It was actually our English department head, Sarah Cox. We have, for the most part, not all classes, but they're heterogeneously grouped. And there's a freshman English class that has heterogeneous students, but there's some honors level students in that class. She took the honors level students during clipper time to enhance their writing and their reading, to give them a little extra, because she knew they had already mastered what they needed to master, and so she was going to take it a little bit further. And that helps the classroom teacher, too, because that teacher knows during, and it didn't take them out of their class. Mm-hmm. It took them during this period where they're not missing any other academic time.
Yeah. There was a time that tracking was prevalent in schools, grouping students with similar cognitive abilities together. Then there was a move toward inclusion where classes were mixed with students of all abilities. Where are we today with the, you know, that rationale behind both of these approaches to teaching?
I think at Falmouth High School, we go for heterogeneous because for the most part, but we, you know, of course we have tracking where you've got AP chemistry or AP English, and certain students will qualify to get into those classes. But I think the benefit of heterogeneous grouping, it benefits all students. Higher achieving students can help lower achieving students, and lower achieving students can maybe realize they can achieve, actually. There's many reasons why students don't achieve in school, and it's not always due to ability. Mm-hmm. It can be anything from home life to just a mental health issue, a variety of issues. So I think that having students group together like that is, for me, I've seen the benefit of it.
I think that you need some of both. I think the ideal balance is where the kids do mix in a total heterogeneous group. But you also need opportunities for kids not to feel intimidated if they're on the low end, and say, oh, those kids are so smart, I'll never be that smart, and give up. And that happens as well as them being motivated by these kids. But frequently they just feel like, oh, they're smart and they can do it, I can't. So you kind of have to be careful. And the kids who are really bright need an opportunity to be able to communicate and feel like they belong with somebody. It's just a case of where there's got to be a really nice balance. And I think the most important thing in a school is a relationship with a teacher or a staff member or, a guidance counselor, anybody in a school, that this student, no matter where they fall, feel like they can go to that person and know they're going to be there for them if, you know, whatever the issue is.
Right. Yeah. I talked to Maya, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Maya. Maya, are you there? All right, we'll let them figure out what the phones are doing there. Teachers can be certified, of course, as special education teachers. And Massachusetts also has a license for teachers in academically advanced studies. Carol, tell us about this. This is not new?
This is not new at all. This has been around for quite a few years. We actually didn't start tracking the number of teachers in this. And there used to be a lot of school districts. Somewhere's at least 80 that we could track back around the year before 2000 that were in academically advanced education. From 2003 until the present, only 29 teachers across the entire state have been trained in gifted education to receive an academically advanced license. And, you know, there's over 8,000 teachers that are practicing. And I think a lot of times these kids, particularly in the lower levels, by third grade, a lot of these kids hit a brick wall. And because the teachers have been trained in special education as part of their pre-service training, and they've been trained in PBIS, which is positive behavior intervention support, teachers see these kids who are bored out of their heads acting out, and they end up getting mislabeled as a result because there's nobody on staff to really recognize what's going on with the child.
I'd love to hear from parents who have kids who might be a little bit bored in school and how they deal with that. 866-999-4626, how to keep them interested in enjoying school. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What do you think about this clipper time? Have you heard of, are the schools doing that you know of?
I think that's fabulous. When my kids were at Framingham High School, they had this thing after school where school, I think, ended at like 2:10. It started at some unbelievable 6:30 or something like that in the morning. But when school ended at 2:10, all the teachers stayed until 3 o'clock, and any student could go see any teacher And my son used to hang out with his best friend's chemistry teacher. Or else he was found in the AP bio teacher's classroom after school. And it was just, I mean, he felt he had a place where he belonged, and other kids like him hung out there. And it was just, it was great. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that Clipper time is just fabulous.
Do you know what other schools are doing that?
Yes, yeah. We actually, I learned about it. I first saw it, it was October of 2015. I went to a NEASC Model Schools Conference, and I saw a high school in New Hampshire that was, they called it their task period, teachers and academic support centers. And it requires a lot of planning. Mm-hmm. You know, Falmouth High School, mm-hmm. I put a scheduling committee together and we really looked at it. And we had to actually shave 6 minutes off of each period in order to gain this time. And mm-hmm. I was worried about it, and teachers were rightfully so worried about it. But now we started it this past November, and so far, so good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kids like it?
Kids seem to really mm-hmm. like it. Parents and guardians seem to like it, and teachers seem to like it. We've really been monitoring it very closely. And, you know, the last time I was here, we were talking about homework. It has helped with homework. And Carol just mentioned, you know, you can stay after school. And kids are so busy these days that getting them while they're already mm-hmm. at school during the school day for any kind of extra support or enhancement that they mm-hmm. need is so much better. It's after school can be hit or miss.
Right. Yeah. What about this? I think you touched on this earlier, Mary, but what about the students with different gifts or talents? Perhaps somebody who's gifted musically or artistically. Are public schools in a position to help nurture and advance these kinds of gifts?
I would love it if Falmouth was like a Weston or a Wellesley or a Lexington of the world with all the money. And I think that's what it boils down to. When a town or a city is willing to fund, you know, and Falmouth actually is. Falmouth is very well funded. But, you know, unlike other towns, we don't have families with a lot of money. And I think that's where, you know, when you go to a Weston high school, you've got families who also are contributing a lot of money and services to schools to help offer additional resources to students who may have unique interests.
Yeah. Rich, I want to bring you in here, too, as well, because, you know, sometimes the special needs students are quite artistic. I mean, they have these great artistic abilities. Are they getting what they need in the public schools, do you think?
I think they have the opportunity to do that, and particularly when you think about different disability types, the notion of heterogeneous groupings allows you to allow those students to express or to be able to really engage around the things that they're really good at, and they might be, you know, intuitive in a certain way or musically gifted or whatever. We now see a lot of kids with autism, for instance, that in some ways they're more limited, and then in other ways they have these exceptionalities that kind of spike up in different places. And so you see that blending occurring. I think of my own daughter who has Down syndrome. She participated in a science class in, I think it was the eighth grade, that was building solar cars back when solar was still something pretty new to us. And she was then invited with her small group of three other students to participate in a solar derby at MIT.
Wow.
And between the four of them, they were able as a group to construct a creative car which looked like a little mouse, and they actually took first place for design. Mm. And what they told us later is that the other students were really focused on the sort of scientific parts of it, and my daughter was focused on the design part of it and what would make it cute. Well, she was able to contribute meaningfully to the point that the whole project was viewed with some honor and exceptionality. So yeah. I think it's the blending of mm-hmm. those skills that working together allows for that to happen. We've been focused a lot on trying to encourage schools to use universal design methods for learning. Mm-hmm. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act, now known as Every Student Succeeds Act, uses that phrase, I think, 12 or 14 times throughout the body of that new law that was passed last year, that schools can use these principles and implement them in classrooms to try to enrich and meet the needs of all students. I think Mary said that that's their goal at Falmouth mm-hmm. High, and that's mm-hmm. the goal of most schools.
Yeah. And I know, Mary, you weren't at Falmouth High when my daughter was there, but she was sped everything except art, AP art. So you're just taking advantage of the opportunities. And I don't think I would have thought of putting mm-hmm. her in AP art, but it was part of that IEP conversation that she was very gifted artistically and that was a better class for her to be in. And again, the teachers were, you know, Jane Baker.
Yes. Oh, she's amazing.
She's a wonderful art teacher. Absolutely great. We've been talking a lot about children at opposite ends of the spectrum. But what about those kids who might be in the middle there? They don't have behavioral or attendance issues. Does that cause them to fly under the radar and not be as engaged as they could be? What about your kids who are kind of in that middle ground?
I think sometimes they want to fly under the radar. And I think I know at Falmouth High School, we really try to look at every student. And teachers, I think Carol said it before, and I've always been a proponent of this, it's all about relationships. And I can't say enough about the faculty at the high school. It really is just, I inherited it, so it's nothing. It has nothing to do with me. But they're just an amazing group of people who love to teach and love what they do and work with every single child. And, you know, I always say no child comes to school to fail. If a student is coming to school, he or she's coming to do something. And I think the teachers at Falmouth High School seize upon that.
Yeah. Of course, parents and guardians play an important role in their child's education, starting at the elementary age. What are some of the ways parents can stay active and engaged in what is happening in the classroom? I was surprised, just thinking back on teacher-parent conferences, how many parents didn't go.
Go ahead, Carol.
Well, I think that a lot of the things that a parent can help with is if a kid has a passion, to make sure the teacher's aware of that. Because a lot of times when I sit in parent conferences with teachers and my son would say, I'm not doing that stupid diorama. I hate artsy stuff. That's dumb. And, you know, I was talking with the teacher and then I said, the teacher says, well, ask him what he'd rather do. I'll let him do an alternate assignment. Well, that child in second grade wrote a 16-page book on Frontier Times and Abraham Lincoln. And you knew it was his because it had things in it that said, and he married Mary Todd. Yuck. Things like this. But I think that if the teacher's aware of a child's passion, even if it's a quiet, you know, sort of middle of the road kind of kid that would slide under the radar, that teacher can take things and toss them to that kid. Mm. And again, it's all about forming relationships.
I think for I don't look askance at parents and guardians who may not come to a meeting or a conference or open house night, because many parents are, you know, school is a scary place. We're the authority figures. They don't even, or they're working three jobs. You know, I think that's one of the things that in Falmouth the superintendent has really emphasized since she's been in that position, is family engagement and trying to reach out to all families and let them know that the schools are a welcoming place.
Mm-hmm. So let's just take a parent who's working three jobs and can't come to that teacher-parent conference or the open house. What's the alternative?
We will try to do phone conversations, mm-hmm. Anything that we can do to meet their schedule.
Mm-hmm. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about getting the most of a public school education with Mary Gans, principal at Falmouth High School, Carol Locke, president of the Massachusetts Association for Gifted Children, and Rich Robeson, executive director of the Federation for Children with Special Needs. We'd love to hear from you. What are some of the ways you make sure your child is succeeding and enjoying school? 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So, at the elementary level, it can be easier to stay in the loop with your child's teacher. But as students get older, they're assuming more responsibility for their schoolwork and often have a number of different teachers. So what are your thoughts on how parents can remain engaged?
I know at Falmouth High School, that's all I can speak to. The teachers and I, we all pretty much have an open door policy. I'll welcome any parent or guardian in, even unannounced, to talk. I even say to the eighth grade parents from the Lawrence Junior High, if you're considering any other high school, please come and see me. And I've had parents take me up on that. Tell me why, you know, Falmouth High School is better than, you know, Sturgis Charter School or whatever. But I think that the way communication is just important. I do, though, encourage when, you know, we are dealing with high school students, I like a high school student to advocate for him or herself, mm-hmm. as long as he feels safe and comfortable in doing so. Mm-hmm. And there are times, though, where a student has advocated and doesn't get anywhere, and a parent has to step in, mm-hmm. And that's fine. But I think it's just knowing that if parents and guardians know the lines of communication are open and they can reach out to anybody at the school, that that's the first step.
So this was interesting. You said, come see, you know, why not Falmouth High? It's almost like when you're going to look at colleges.
Right.
You go and you visit and you see and maybe have a shadow day.
Yes, and we do that. Yeah. We'll let students shadow. Yeah.
Let's talk to Linda, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I was just calling because I was listening to the previous comment about parent conferences. Mm-hmm. And I taught in Sandwich a long time ago, and I have a daughter now who has two little ones who go to school. And I feel like I need to just remind parents how important it is to communicate with the teachers. An overriding impression that I have is that I viewed every child differently after I had met the parents, mm-hmm. and heard about the child from their point of view. And again, with schedule today, it could be by phone. But the parents just know the children's little idiosyncrasies, or their personalities, or their fears, or their strengths. Sometimes conferences don't take place until so far into the school year, but I really viewed the children very differently after I had talked to their parents.
Yeah. Linda, I think that's very helpful information, and everybody's nodding here in the studio. Thanks for sharing that. That's, I think it's granted that teachers can't be talking to every parent every day. One of the things that we did when my daughter was in school is we had a notebook in the younger grades that would go back. So, you know, the teacher would write a little note about how the day was, and I would write a little note. And if she came home without that notebook, we got in the car and went to school to find the notebook because that meant something happened that she didn't want me to know about. There's a lot of different ways you can communicate besides, you know, being in person and on the phone. You just have to work that out with the teachers, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So it's not uncommon for students in middle or junior high to start complaining that school is no longer fun. There are those who argue that not all in life is fun and that children must learn to cope, and others who believe learning should be joy. So what are your thoughts on that?
I actually am probably the former. I don't think that teachers should be viewed as entertainers. I mean, I think they're there to teach. And quite frankly, I've come across very few students who actually say, oh, I'm so bored. I think there's a lot of reasons why kids are bored, not the least of which is we've now raised a generation of kids who are hyper-scheduled. Mm-hmm. And when they do have some downtime, they think of that as being bored. Well, I just try not to use the word bored in my vocabulary. I think there's a lot of reasons why kids say they're bored when they could be really just downtime is good for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's really a cultural sort of shift that when I was a little kid, we had many, many hours with nothing to do. I grew up in the country, and my sister and I used to find all sorts of incredible creative things to do with our time. And when I'm dating myself now, when Sesame Street first came out, I was in graduate school, and this other friend of mine and I used to run and watch this TV show. And one day she said, you know, this is totally going to revolutionize education, and I'm not sure it's good. Mm. That a certain amount of this activity and funsy learning and everything else is great, but the kids still need to know how to sit still and be quiet, mm-hmm. and absorb things. And
what my mother used to say when I would say I was bored, she'd say, find something to do or I'll find something for you.
Or maybe being bored is good.
Yeah.
Then be
I
bored.
So. Yeah. Yeah, be bored. Yes. Exactly. All right, Rich, I want to start with you on this. What are some signs your child might not be working to his or her or full potential? And what would be your, and I'm thinking, you know, as younger kids, and you're thinking maybe my child has a learning disability or there's some issues here. What are some signs that you'd be looking for?
Well, I think the first one that we always look for is when the student starts to show some anxiety at home and resistance to wanting to go to school. Mm-hmm. That's a nice red flag, mm-hmm. to say, what's going on and how can we help you? I think, you know, basically every one of us, any human being, wants to feel confident and competent, mm-hmm. in what we do. Right. And when we're challenged with new things, we don't. You know, if we go and sing happy birthday in a public place, most of us don't want to do it solo.
That's for sure.
Because we get a little self-conscious. Mm-hmm. So it raises the anxiety of the student. But if it gets to the point that the student, your child is feeling like, I can't do it, I can't go to school, then to begin to start to unravel that. And I think that's where the communication with the school and then the teacher in particular becomes so, so important. You know, be able to talk about what's happening at home, what's happening mm-hmm. in the classroom. Are you seeing any of this? Some students are really good at masking it and mm-hmm. as somebody said, staying below the radar. But really, the parent knows that child the best.
Yeah.
And they're going to see when something like this starts to emerge. And to address it early,
mm-hmm.
once it gets to the point that the student's failing repeatedly, it's a downward cycle and we really need to jump on it. But I would say early sensitivity, and even if it turns out to be nothing, better to have the conversation with the teacher, get the relationship built, understand yeah. what's going on, and then try to do what we can do to help the student get through those difficult spots.
Yeah, and that's not just for special needs students. That goes for every student.
Everybody.
And I'm thinking, and Mary, I'm going to ask you this question. I'm thinking, and this was a while ago, I think we've come a long way in addressing the bullying issue, but I had a friend whose daughter, she was sick every day. She didn't want to go to school, and she would cry, and it turned out that she was being bullied. But at the same time, she did not want her mom to talk. She was like, no, you can't say anything. It'll make it worse.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with that when parents come to you and say, I feel like my child's being bullied, or my child is the bully?
Well, we take it very seriously, and you know, many times parents and students do say, but don't say anything, and we do our best to maintain confidentiality if we can, but I take any kind of I don't always like to use the word bully, but any kind of mean behavior, harassing behavior, we just take it very seriously at the high school and address it head on. And I think one of the challenges is with, and it's not just school use, but cell phones and mm-hmm. social media.
So I was going to say social media, yeah.
You know, a lot of times we'll get a student come in the morning and say, so-and-so was saying negative things about me on Instagram last night. And what's interesting is the school then is always viewed as, you know, it had nothing to do with school. It happened at home. But the school is the resource, which is great. We want to be the helpful resource, but we sometimes have to explain to people, if it's true harassment, it's happening at home, we need to get the police involved too. Mm-hmm. This is not just a school issue.
Yeah. So do you talk with students then? I mean, like in your assemblies and about what is bullying and, you know, what is harassment and all of that?
Yeah, we do. We try to. I know at the younger ages in all of the schools here in Falmouth, there's a heavy emphasis on that.
Mm-hmm. Carol, there are a number of enrichment opportunities beyond. Oh, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on that for just a second.
Yeah.
I think an awful lot of this has to do with the school culture.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get a respectful culture going, and if you have recognition for this artistic student and this theatrical student and mm-hmm. this kid who does awesome poetry or something like that, other kids start respecting that,
mm-hmm.
and that kid no longer is the person pointed at to be picked on.
Mm-hmm.
And our school, when I was at school in Framingham, it was elementary school, the principal had insisted that we all take a course in multiple intelligences. And then we had all the kids decide where their best, strongest suits were.
Mm-hmm.
And it just literally had this huge effect on the school's culture because we had a very diverse population. We had Hispanic kids and we had Brazilian kids and everything else. And it was fabulous, the difference it made in the school.
I was going to say, even like with the special needs kids, I'm going to go back to my daughter's experience where she had a really tough time with reading. And when a friend's younger daughter was, you know, reading away, that was really a blow to her. She said, I can't, look how good she reads. I can't read like that. And you turn around, but can she draw like you can draw? So bringing out those everybody has their strong points and everybody has their weaknesses, and you work on the weaknesses. So Carol, I was going to ask you the number of enrichment opportunities beyond the school, everything from after school to summer programs. What are some of the options out there that are generally made available to students, regardless of the ability to pay?
That's tough. There are a lot of programs available of summer camps. There's the Summer Institute for the Gifted at BU. There's an online type program through Johns Hopkins University called Center for Talented Youth, CTY, that offers all sorts of wonderful courses, and there's instructors with them. The trouble is there's really no financing for these. MAGE has a small scholarship program that we're now starting to get more and more people involved in that can do this. We've been able to form a few liaisons and get students into programs. The Russian School of Math is another one where we can slide one or two students in on scholarship. But it's very difficult for the parents who don't have the resources.
Yeah. The Trump administration is taking a different approach to education than the Obama administration, most notably by supporting school choice that could include the use of vouchers. What are your thoughts on vouchers and how this might impact the public education system? Tough question.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me going on that one. Well, you know what? So even aside from vouchers, I know that there are good charter schools out there, and I know that there are reasons for them. But charter schools and the one in our neck of the woods, and it's a good school, I get it, but they're held to a different standard. And they can say they accept anyone but by lottery, but if you have a sibling who's gone there, then you get a preference and you get a seat. Falmouth High School takes everybody. We don't pick and choose. And I think that's the beauty of a public school. So I think public schools should be open to anybody. And when you start talking about vouchers and charters, that takes the public out of it. So I don't, those schools are okay, but it bothers me that so much public funding goes to those schools at, in my opinion, the expense of true public schools.
Anybody else want to chime in on that?
Oh, sure. Well, I think that, and I used to work at the Department of Education as well, and I've been to many, many schools across the state. And whether you're talking a charter school or a public school or anything else, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. Mm-hmm. And we have this thing where we want to group everything and say it's either black or white. And so I think we have to be very, very careful about saying all charter schools are good and all public schools are bad, because that's simply not true. I also feel like when you're talking vouchers, we really need to have a sense of what these vouchers cover. Mm-hmm. Does a private school cost $10,000 and the voucher's worth $1,000? Because you can easily be excluding a huge chunk of the population in that way. And we have no idea what this, until the whole system is really laid out on paper, as to whether it's something that even has a prayer of working. Yeah. But I agree with Mary also on the fact that it's not a public school if it doesn't take
Rich, we have about a minute left. Do you want to chime in?
Well, I would just agree and then also say I think the details are the key piece. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen any details about what might be coming down the road from the new administration. If they mimic what we've heard they might, which is Florida's model and things like that, the one key thing that we would worry about is that by the parent accepting the voucher, they're actually signing away their legal rights to a free appropriate public education. Mm. And that's of concern to us, obviously. Yeah.
So a little less than a minute. Mary, just in closing, advice to parents about how you get the best out of the public education for their student.
Just don't be afraid to approach the school. And if you have a complaint, complain. You know, that's what to echo Carol's words, I want to hear the good, the bad, the ugly. I mean, we want to do the best for every child at Falmouth High School. And if you have anything to let us know, my door is literally always open.
All right. About 30 seconds, Carol, for those with gifted kids. Oh, advice, 30
great.
Seconds.
Find a passion for them and let the teachers know that passion.
Okay. And Rich, I'll give you another 20 seconds.
Great. I would say build partnerships with the school. Work collaboratively. You're going to be in this relationship for a very long time. You're going to go over lots of bumps and lots of victories, and you want to celebrate and also hit those challenges together.
All right. Rich Robeson is Executive Director of the Federation for Children with Special Needs. Carol Locke is President of the Massachusetts Association for Gifted Children, and Mary Gans is a principal at Falmouth High School. Thank you all for joining us this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.